And what was San Diego State like? And give me a sense of what the environment was like when you came here.
Well, you know, I came to San Diego State, I think, because I thought it would not be like UCLA.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, it has become UCLA. I have to say that now. But I came here because I didn't want to be in a paper mill, a publish or perish, uh-huh. do or die. I had lived through that as an undergraduate, and I wasn't impressed with it. You know, I'd lived through an experience where, you know, you go to class and you're 600 people. You know, and I lived through the experience that I can't remember hardly any of my professors' names because, you know, there's 600 in this class, 300 in that, you know, so many here, the students you never know. So when I came to San Diego State, I was impressed that the largest class was 40 students.
Mm.
Yeah, I was impressed that the largest history class was 40 students at this university. There were not these 60, 70 student kind of classes or even 100, 200, or the 500 that we have now. But we were really a teaching institution with 40 students, professors who cared about students, and I think many of them still do, who put their research and their interest of students equal on the scale,
yeah.
and saw their research as a way to improve themselves as professors rather than just improve themselves in the status of the field. And so when I came to San Diego State, there were about 25,000 students. San Diego was somewhat backwards in a weird sense because we had some quirky things here. Like when I first came, I couldn't figure out why there was like thousands of people on this grass lined up. They were registering. I'm thinking, have you guys heard of computers? I mean, you know, I had registered by computer since the day I entered UCLA in 1966. You know, fill out this little form, mail it in, mail registration. And here they were, every student who had to come in person, mm-hmm. in person to actually register for campus. 25,000 kids. We to this day, we still have what I call hunting license for parking lots. Because at UCLA, you get lot number A, or F, or 10, or 17, whatever the number is. And you know when you go to that lot, because they figured it out, any time of day you put your little key in, there's going to be a park somewhere in that lot for you. And even if you're in the lot out on Wilshire Boulevard and they have shuttle you back and forth, you know that that's your lot and that's where you park. So you go to the lot every day. I was here at San Diego State probably about a week before I had a car accident. Somebody hit me trying to get a lot. We both see in this spot. We don't know whose fault it was because we're in this parking lot and it's panic time and there's one part and we both head for it. Bam. I don't know who was right, wrong, or whatever. But I thought, this is ridiculous. And it was that way. And in fact, we had a lot less parking than we have today. And the campus was known as a place where you purchased a hunting license, not a parking license, but a hunting
That's
license.
Funny.
And you hunted for a park every time you came to this campus. And it was really horrible. I mean, we had such a horrible reputation. No one wanted to come to campus if they didn't have to come in terms of community and people like that. Because we didn't have these huge parking structures across the street and places. We had these various little lots, poorly mapped out. And so here we have this wonderful campus, 25,000 students, you know, growing in terms of its prominence and importance as a campus, and you've got this. When I came here, we were San Diego State College.
Right.
And then we became a Cal State system. And we thought, okay, we'll be CSUSD. And everybody in San Diego, because we have this identity problem down here, they had a fit, they petitioned, they this, they that. And so we, along with, I guess, San Francisco State and one or two other campuses, got a chance to be San Jose State University, SDSU.
Right,
you know, we got a chance to have our identity within the CSU. I thought, what a bunch of crap. But anyway, it didn't matter to me. I thought it was kind of cool being a part of the CSU, but everybody wanted the identity, and I didn't have the long history of San Diego. So it was fine with me not to have to deal with that. But when I came to San Diego State, obviously, there had just been, how I got here was interesting. I had begun to teach part-time at Cal State LA. And I had no intentions, first of all, of ever being in Black Studies. That's the interesting piece. Mm-hmm. My area was speech communication with rhetorical theory focused on African-American movements. But I got this, I was teaching a class in the speech department at Cal State LA, part-time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd done really well, had great evaluations. And so the chair of the department sent me a note saying, we just got this notice. Thought you might be interested. And it was from San Diego State, and it was a position opening at San Diego State for a assistant professor to teach in the Black Studies department, but to teach speech.
Oh.
Because one of the things that I discovered when I came here was that this Black Studies unit was called the college. It was called a school of African American Studies initially. And contained within the school, we had speech classes, we had writing classes, we had math classes. So there was a component in it to support students academically so they could be successful in everything else. So I was invited to come down for this. So I sent my resume in thinking, oh, that'd be interesting. And I got a call to come for an interview. And Harold Brown was coordinating. Well, I got here and discovered, first of all, that there had been some protests on campus that year, that the Black Studies Department had kind of started back in the late 60s, mm-hmm. and about 68, 69, Carol right. Wayman was telling me. And they had started, but they really hadn't developed a department. They had an agreement with various departments about classes so that the history class was still listed as History 1 something something. Uh-huh. Speech was still 103, mm-hmm. the class we taught. And so every class existed, but it was still under the auspices of the traditional department. And they had people hired to teach. Well, Carol Wayman became and Carol, I think, was one of the persons kind of coordinating this effort. He was a psychologist. So the students, however, decided that they wanted a full-fledged department. They didn't want this stuff scattered around. There had been a number of things that happened on campus. And so as a result, they had this protest on campus. I understand they burned a couple of trash cans in front of the president's office, so forth and
was
so on.
Was it then that Rage Golding was president?
No, this was Walker. Walker was president, a guy by the name of Walker. I never met Walker because by the time I got here, Colburn was really running the show until Rage Golding came the next year. But Walker was president when they were burning trash cans and stuff and that kind of thing, and had this protest. And so then they brought in Harold Brown, who was a former student at San Diego State, an athletic, I guess he had a degree in PE or something, but he was brought in as the assistant to the assistant president or something. He was assistant to the vice president. And this was the kind of position they were forming around the country. They bring these Black people who were assistant to somebody to kind of organize and coordinate stuff. So Harold was brought in, really wasn't an academician, but brought in. His area was in business and athletics. Was brought in because he had run CORE, I think, in San Diego, Congress of Racial Equality. It was kind of a homegrown entity. So he was brought in to basically organize us and to bring together a Black Studies unit. And he came in and began to do that to kind of, you know, in other words, keep the natives from getting restless and those kinds of things. And so I came down for one of the interviews. When I got here, there was a woman who had been brought in the spring, and she really was the first tenure-track hire, and that was Florence Gilkison. She was a historian, and actually in the doctoral program at UCLA. And she was already here the spring semester before most of us came in the fall. So Harold Brown's task was to put together a group of people to come in to develop a Black Studies department. But I thought about it. I got this job offer, and I was at the time I was thinking, I don't know. You know, San Diego's 120 miles away, and my mother was livid by then because she just figured there's no way in the world I'm going to move 120 miles away from Los Angeles. First of all, I had moved into an apartment, so that was by the time I got my bachelor's degree, I moved into an apartment, which is unheard of in my family because there are eight of us, six girls, two boys. I'm number six in line, so they're, you know, four sisters. Is older than me, and one younger, and so none of them had ever moved out. Everybody had moved from mama's house to their husband's house.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
everybody. But my sisters told me when I was at UCLA, whatever you do, don't allow mama to not let you move into an apartment. Don't force yourself to get married simply because you want to get out of the house. And of course, I was a little different than my sisters anyway, so I said, well, you know, that's not likely to happen because I always had this kind of rebellious spirit anyway. So I said, that is not likely to happen for me. And so by the time I graduated and got my bachelor's degree, in fact, I was working on my master's. I moved into an apartment. And my mother was just... She thought that was the worst thing in the world. In fact, she called the minister of the church to tell him that I needed to go home, to have him to convince me to come home. And he was like, Sister Nash, you know, Shirley's like 22 years old. He said, I really don't think I need to call her to come home. She's got a bachelor's degree working on a master's. He said, she got more degrees than I have. What am I going to tell her? Well, he says, you know, she's a good kid. She's grown, in other words. My mother just thought it was horrible, one, that I moved to an apartment. That was number one, horrible. Then I moved to San Diego, 120 miles away. So obviously I'm beginning to exhibit all these unusual characteristics of my grandmother. you know, this free spirit. I'm going to move to San Diego. I don't know a soul in San Diego.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody, but I'm coming to San Diego. So my mother was really very much opposed to that. But I think my dad was not opposed to it. He said, well, first of all, she's only 120 miles. You can get there in 2 hours, okay? At that time, PSA, the airline here, kind of like Southwest, but it was called PSA at the time, it was $16 round trip from L.A. to San Diego.
Right.
Delta was $8.40-something round trip from San Diego. I mean, you know, it's just crazy that, you know, that such tremendous change in cost. But, you know, so to fly here was 30 minutes, you know, back and forth if you really want to fly. 2 hours a drive. And when I moved here, you know, like Irvine wasn't really developed very well. Irvine was onion fields.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, all that wonderful development. In fact, once you kind of left Costa Mesa, and you got to, it took you to almost to get to probably Del Mar or someplace like that before you really saw civilization, or Oceanside, before you really saw civilization again, because everything in between, maybe San Clemente was there. It was there. San Clemente was there. But a lot of that was nothing. All those condos and the development, they were all farmland and fields and everything else. So, you know, so my parents thought it was a little bit creepy for me to drive sometimes because, you know, once you left one place, you didn't see a service station forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the time, I was dating my husband. And so if I had to stay late, he would drive me back to San Diego and then fly home because it was only $8 to fly home, you know, big deal. But I moved to San Diego, and like I said, and that was like unheard of. And my sisters were like, they thought it was so funny because they said, God, Mom must pray all the time that you're safe, that you're this, you're that. Because it's just unheard of for me to move to a place, an apartment. I didn't know anybody. I'm coming to a job and, you know, that whole kind of thing. But my dad said, you know what, you have to expect this, that if she's done all this education, she's done all this training, she's got to go somewhere. She's gonna leave the nest. And so he wasn't as upset. He was kind of proud about it. You know, my mom was a little bit, oh, my God, you know, that kind of stuff. But it, and everybody kept telling us, it's only 120 miles, you know, away. And so she finally adjusted to it. She began, and I think my husband, I didn't get married that year. I got married after I got here in April. I finally married my husband, and we had this huge wedding, and so my parents felt a little bit more comfortable because at least I had somebody down here to take care of me.
Well, is he from San Diego?
My husband was actually from New Orleans, but he lived in Los Angeles. I met him when he was a law student at UCLA. So we met on the campus of UCLA and dated for, I think, a couple of years. And then after I moved to San Diego, he finished law school, and then he decided to come to San Diego. He decided we'd get married. He was studying for the bar, so he moved to San Diego. My thinking was I'd be in San Diego for about a year.
Oh.
Because this was a slow town. And I thought, okay, in 1 year I'm out of here. Okay. And, you know, 30-some-odd years later, you know, you're still in San Diego. But I thought I'd be gone. But I came here, and I kind of like the San Diego community. Initially, he and I spent a lot of time traveling back and forth to L.A. because all our friends were there. And then we came to realize this is kind of ridiculous. You've got to establish a life in San Diego.
Right.
San Diego was not a... The campus itself was a. I found the campus to be very welcoming in terms of the students, and I think that was the attractive part to me, because many students who lived in Los Angeles came to San Diego, because it was far enough to be independent, close mm-hmm. enough to be dependent, so they could beg for money, run up and pick up stuff, take their dirty clothes home, but at the same time they could be in San Diego and Mom not know that they're dating somebody that she would never approve of. So as a result, there were lots of students who came to San Diego. In fact, there were more kids and African-American students in San Diego who were not San Diegans than there were. Hmm. San Diego does a very poor job, and still does to a certain extent, of attracting the kids from San Diego, because naturally they want to go away. So they go to L.A., and the L.A. kids come here.
Yeah.
So I found a tremendous group of young people who were really interested in going to school here, who really needed mentors and support, and there were so few of us. You know, I think when I came on campus, there might have been 2, maybe 3 African American faculty outside of Black Studies, you know, and most of them had only been here a short while. Wally Miles had been here, I think, the longest, maybe about 3 or 4. No, Wally probably had been here since the mid 60s, because he came at a time when they couldn't even find housing for him, because no one would rent to an African American in this area.
What is his field?
Wally Miles. He's a political scientist. And he was very instrumental in the development of Black Studies, because he became our one personnel member who was tenured full professor, who could serve on committees for us, who represented all of us on personnel committees, who was instrumental in getting our contracts done with Harold Brown. And so Wally Miles was a full professor when I arrived here. He's retired since then. He retired a few years ago. But he was one of the first faculty members to come to San Diego State. He wasn't the first, but among the first, and the one who stayed the longest in terms of coming, and was very instrumental in helping us. But the campus itself was... you know, it was very, very small in terms of its thinking. In many ways, it was a small college with a whole bunch of students, because it didn't conceptualize things like registration by mail, you know?
Yeah.
Things that, you know, because like I said, I got in and thought, why are these 25,000 people standing on this grass? I was just blown away. I thought it was a protest coming out of UCLA. I'm thinking, okay, where's my sign, you know? I'm trying to figure out, what are we protesting against today? And I discovered these people are not protesting. They're lined up to register. I thought, are you crazy? And they had to register. School started in September. The whole month of August, if you had priority registration and you lived in New York and your registration was August 1, you flew back to be registered because classes would be so overcrowded, and that it was crazy. And so that was kind of a shock. And then, you know, I learned new terminology like crashing class, because they said, when a lot of students going to want to crash your class, I'm thinking, oh my God, are they going to destroy stuff, tear up stuff?
Oh.
No, they just want to get enrolled. Okay, you know, different terminology, different world. But it was an interesting experience. When I came here, I was 23 years old initially. I turned 24 my first semester here. But I was 23, so naturally all the guys who had been, and the campus had this program called some Pinto program, which got a lot of parolees out. Yeah, no, it was interesting. And so a lot of guys had been in prison, and so a significant number of my students were much older than I was.
Oh.
In fact, some of them have retired. I've had some students who were working at the university going to school, and since then they have retired, and you know, got grandkids, and I'm actually working on my second set of grandkids from one of my students. And so it's really kind of interesting. So here I was, 23 years old, all the guys trying to hit on me, because they're like 25, 26, you know, and I'm thinking, I'm not dating you guys, you're my students. And many of the students were so much older. Do you really know anything? You know, I mean, it was that kind of attitude.
Yeah.
And then I remember one time, it was really interesting, because at this time, you know, these guys who thought they got Black Studies started were, you know, the macho guys on campus. And they figured Black Studies is going to be this easy thing. They're not going to really come to class, but they're going to get A's, you know, because that's what it's all about. And so these guys come to me once, and they figured, you know, this is a little kid from L.A. She's probably been in school her whole life, very naive. They knew I was raised in the projects and, you know, real survival techniques, big family. So they come in, and so this guy sits down, and he's going to tell me what's going to happen in my class. He says, you know, I want you to understand the rules of this university, and that we don't plan to come to class, but we also plan to get A's. And he's telling me this crazy stuff. So I'm looking at this nut, you know, and I said, obviously, you don't understand the nature of this game. I said, there's only one person directing the rules in this class, and I'm that person. So you either play by the game or you don't join this game at all. You don't understand, little girl. You know, we could put sugar in your tank. No, he said, we could put sugar in your tank, your car. We know what kind of car you have. And I laughed, and I think they thought I was crazy. I started laughing. I said, you know what? He said, what? I said, we did that in the projects when I was a kid. We put sugar in people's tanks in their projects when I was a kid. I said, now my friends go on 103rd in Compton and find somebody, and you'll never be found again. And he goes, and he looked at me, eyes got big, like, oh my God, this woman's a mafia or something, you know. But it was really funny. I thought it was so. I said, you don't put sugar in my tank. Oh my God, we did that in kindergarten, elementary school in the projects. I said, I lived in the Pueblos, and they go, oh, I mean, Pueblos were the famous projects, and I'm like, you know, hey, we did that when we were kids. Yeah, I said, you guys got to grow up. If you're going to attack me, at least come as an adult. Mm-hmm. And so they decided at some point that the guys on campus say, you're crazy. I said, I am. So that's a good thing, though. And so in the end, they didn't enroll in my class, and it was wonderful, because I told them, you need to go play by these rules if you don't play the game at all. But I guess it was all a testing thing to see.
Yeah.
One, if she's going to be intimidated, if it's going to be somebody we could really rip off and do this kind of stuff. And they learned very quickly. It didn't happen that way. It wasn't going to happen. And so you either go by the program or you don't. And so they never took my class. They said I was too hard. I said, well, yeah, I am, because I require you to come to class. And that's a hard thing, you know, and to do your work.
Yeah.
But it was interesting. I came here, and like I said, I had no idea what kind of experience I would have. And it was unique, because the people in the room, when we first came, They had structured, they thought about what kind of support students would need to survive on this campus. And so what they thought about was, okay, they need basic skills because they had kids coming who couldn't write, who could not speak well, and those kind of things. So they said, well, we need to do speech, we need to do writing, we need to do, and those pieces are still central to the department. We even had math and statistics at one point in the department. But they became central to at least introducing students to the field of Black Studies, but also getting the necessary skills they need to be able to negotiate the university and to then to meet a professor that they would probably be able to relate to when a class of 20 That's to great. 30 students and mentor those students through the process of the university. Mm-hmm. So that became, you know, so we recognized that that was a part of it, that we had a unique role on campus to not only teach classes, but to represent the interest of African-American yeah. students and community.
Yeah.
Because our we recognize the fact that the community protested to get us here. Okay, we were all very qualified and credentialed, but we recognized that that was not what got us here. What got us here was a group of people who demanded that they hire people of color to come. Mm-hmm. And they saw, and in my case, I recognized that, you know, that much of my travel and my journey through academia was made easier by a professor who believed in me, who supported me, mm-hmm. who exposed me to things that others would not expose me to. And so, you know, so I've made that kind of my mission to make sure that their students get other things, not only the class, but they learn about professional organizations, they travel to conferences, they get the mentorship, they get the internships, they get the international travel, they get those things that make a difference in their lives. Yeah. And so we set out to build this department. None of us had ever been in Black Studies before, and which is, you know, so there are lots of trials and errors. We all came from different areas. None of us had ever taught Black Studies before. Mm-hmm. We'd studied African Americans, but we had not conceptualized the idea of a discipline or a set of courses, what is central. So you start with the basics of history and literature and those kinds of things. And then you begin to start networking. And so it was interesting for us initially because our task was to develop a department to present to the Academic Senate in the spring. We were sponsored in a number of activities. I know that I went to a couple of conferences at San Francisco State that had started the first Black Studies department. Had a chance to meet with Nathan Hare, who started Black Studies in San Francisco. And in fact, we had ended up inviting Nathan Hare to come to campus to speak to us. We began to look at what other people were doing around the country. But keep in mind, in 1972, most departments were doing the same thing we were doing.
Yeah.
Asking questions, trying to figure out what the yeah. discipline was really all about. There were a few departments like San Francisco and others, Northridge, Cal State LA, that were a little bit ahead of us. But we had all the challenges that were there in terms of a department. So our first year was spent in meetings. I can't even begin to tell you the number of meetings we had. I mean, we must have met, if not 3 to 4 times a week. Mm-hmm. Hours upon hours. I can remember falling asleep in meetings at midnight at somebody's house where we were talking about curriculum and arguing about courses and content and materials and things that had to be put together and those kinds of things. So it was really intense. There were about 13 or 14 of us brought in, which was quite interesting because it's the largest department has ever been. And many of them were not all tenure track. About 6 or 7 of us that were tenure track. Mm-hmm. But we had something called HBUD that was brought in. HBUD, which is, human development and human and urban development is something. Human behavior and urban development, HBUD. Human behavior, urban development. And Dr. Chambers, who was the tenure track psychologist, was the director of the HBUD. Harold had gotten a special grant. And this was really a counseling center mm-hmm. for Black students to come in and to be supported and counseled to do well in school. And so we had, and in that HBUD center were 3 other psychologists. So we had these 3 counselors tied into full time, whose task was to work with students, what have you. The center lasted 1 year. That wasn't refunded. It could have been, it should have been, because it was really a good center. But it was soft money that they got for this 1 year. So the counseling component went away, but Dr. Chambers remained, and so did the other members of the faculty. But we worked to, and it was interesting, at this time the campus, unlike it is now, was divided into, like EOP was not EOP. The one program, it had Black EOP, Chicano EOP, Asian EOP, and some other, it had 3 or 4 different EOP offices. Everyone with a separate office, a separate little miniature director, and a program geared toward particular students. Mm-hmm. So it was really quite interesting. I had not seen that in any other campus before. And that lasted for maybe 3 or 4 years that it had these, and then they combined it into one. And that was kind of tense for people because they didn't know whether how it would turn out, who would be left out, who would be included. People thought, well, you know, African Americans will take over. No, the Hispanics will. You know, who will work to make EOP? And the tension around it continues even to this day as to whether or not every group has adequate input and representation into EOP with recruitment and retention of students. But at one point, everybody had their own, and their programs were geared toward African American students. All those programs were there to support them, to nurture them, and that kind of thing. And same was true with Hispanic, same true with Asian, and what have you. And then it was combined into one, supposedly for savings, financial savings, and other kinds of things. And so EOP became one after several years of being divided. We had, you know, the battle for Black Studies on this campus was really quite interesting because we had some natural allies that were supportive. In other words, we had people like a guy named Nick Nichols, and he was a white professor in literature. Nick ran our literature classes for us and invited professors in to teach before I even got here. He invited professors in to teach in his classes, in his comparative lit classes, about African-American literature. So he and some others like him, particularly in the comp lit area, were natural supporters of us in terms of what we were doing. A guy by the name of Cheek, who was teaching history in the history department, Professor Cheek was teaching Black history, and he basically taught the courses until Florence Gilkison came along, and then he continued to be supportive of her. So we had developed some relationships through the years, but one of the realities we live with consistently is that whenever there was budget cuts, whenever there was a shortage of something, people in the campus naturally looked over to Black Studies and say, why can't we get rid of them? So there were always these efforts to combine us. President Day had one effort when he first came here. He wanted to combine the Black Studies departments. President Golding had a program to combine us. The current president doesn't have one, but I remember when one of the efforts in the late 70s during one of the economic crises, they were going to combine Black Studies, Chicano Studies, and Asian Indian Studies and somebody else into one department. And we fought it, and we were successful because one of the things we had always done and continue to do is that we've always maintained a relationship with the larger Black community. And so when anytime there's an attack on one of us, we can immediately pick up the phone and call. And it's not like we have to explain who we are. You know, we don't have to say, oh, you remember us? We did this, we're that. No, because we stay in constant contact with the various communities. And so it was easy for us to say, this is what's going on. We need support. And then we were able to realize, I think at some point the president realized that it wasn't worth the headache to try to combine Black Studies and Chicano Studies. We got together as a department, and we've kind of worked well together as the various departments over the years, because one of the things we did when they were trying to combine us, unlike other departments, we sat down and we said, first of all, we're not going to fight each other. We're not going to allow ourselves to be consolidated. We're not going to discuss who's going to be chair over everybody and who's not, because we're not going to get into that battle. We're going to remain separate departments. And so we all organize our community around the issue that we are separate departments, you know, and that we're very different.
Yeah.
You know, we're different. As I told them, the only thing we share is the oppression of whites. I mean, that's the only thing we share. You know, Chicanos are very different than Black people. Right. Indians are very different than everybody. We have some commonalities, but our histories are different. How we got here is different. Right. You know, how our cultures exist is different. So there are all these differences. And so how all of a sudden you're going to throw us together? I said, you'd be better, basically combining history and literature than you'd be combining us because of the commonality of those areas. So we fought it the first time, and we were successful. And since then, people have talked about it occasionally, but never in the sense of combining them again, because we generally respect each other's area of expertise, and we move on from that. The early stages of Black Studies, we did certain things to keep ourselves, I think, connected to the larger picture of Black Studies and connected nationally and internationally. One of the things we did for probably the first 10 years of the life of the department was that we held an annual conference at San Diego State that was well attended. It was a 2-day conference on Black Studies. And it had it brought in our community colleges, other Cal State campuses in Southern California, so that we could then continue to discuss issues of curriculum, those kinds of things. And that was really before the National Council for Black Studies became such a large organization and a venue for which we could actually take many of our issues. So we participated in a lot of very local conferences mm-hmm. and organized our own local conference here in San Diego. The department itself went through a number of, like I said, we were initially called the School of Afro-American Studies, and that quickly changed because we realized we were not a school. There was a School of Education before there was a College of Education, and we thought, okay, if we're a school, we got to have a dean, we need to have more money, we need to have this, and even though we called ourselves that, we were not a school. Mm-hmm. So eventually we agreed to go into the College of Arts and Letters. They told us, you have a choice. You can do professional studies, fine arts, or arts and letters. We chose arts and letters. Chicano Studies chose professional studies and fine arts. Why, I don't know. But since then, they moved to arts and letters. We found ourselves more aligned with the social sciences and the humanities than with the other areas that were there. But I think they did because they liked the dean that was in the College of Professional Studies and Fine Arts. And our dean was not always the nicest person in the world. But it made more sense to us to be aligned with arts and letters than necessarily to be aligned with the College of Professional Studies and Fine Arts. We were pleased with that because once we became a department, mm-hmm. unlike this nebulous group hanging out here called a school without a dean, without anything else, mm-hmm. we then became the recipient of all the other benefits the departments get, not only in staffing and those kinds of things, but we then had a seat at the chair at the table of the college, so that the Arts and Letters college has one black chair, and I'm it. You know, they've had others over the years in other disciplines, mm-hmm. like in sociology had Phil Gay for a year or two, and somebody else had, I think Spanish had a guy for one or two years. But at least it puts you at the table of decision making about right. curriculum. It also puts you in a position to be eligible to run for Academic Senate. And I spent 6 years on the Academic Senate because I was in the College of Arts and Letters. So those kinds of things that are really talk about power-based participation in curriculum on the Senate level, those kinds of things become important. And they were very important for us because in our initial stage, you know, we were forever defending our existence. I mean, mm-hmm. people will, you know, anytime there was anything at the Senate to talk about cutting or change, they looked at us. Anytime there was a question of what is really the core of the university, they looked at us because they didn't see us as central to the university, as core of the university. So we were forever writing documents, writing papers, sending things to the Senate because somebody would immediately attack us as not being central to the mission of the university or whatever it might be. And so we spent a tremendous amount of our time on the defense in the department, writing things, attending meetings. We were so at a point paranoid that we could never afford not to be at a meeting. You know, if it's the Senate, we can never afford not to be on a committee. That's what I told you, when I look at my early resume of the doggone committees I served on. I mean, I have served on every major committee on this campus, whether it's the Affirmative Action Committee, I've been on the Academic Senate, President of the Academic Planning and Policy, I've been on curriculum committees in the college and the university. You name it, you know, I've served on search committees for Dean of Undergraduate Studies, blah-de-blah-de-blah. We had to serve. I did 6 years on the Senate, boring myself to death in the Academic Senate. But it was one of those critical periods where if we were not there, you know, if we were not there, we wouldn't exist. Mm-hmm. If it's a GE committee, you know, general education, when they're rewriting all of GE, we had to fight to continue to remain in general education. And so we had to be there. We had to, and we'd have people questioning the validity of our discipline. I always tell students, I remember once some woman in Classic and Oral Interlanguages had the nerve to say, but what can you do with a degree in Black Studies? I said, of all the people at the university, you are the last one to ask me that question, you know, because, you know, what can I do with your discipline? And then, you know, immediately people stop and think. And I said, well, what can you do with a degree in sociology? What can you do with any degree? We're not a training school. So we became very good at understanding university and how universities operate.
Interesting.
You know, that there are probably two degrees here you can do something with. One is nursing and the other one is accounting. Beyond that, we're all going to have to market ourselves to be something. Whether it's English or whatever, you got to figure out how to teach. You're going to have to do something. So we ended up, we were warriors in terms of mm-hmm. reading everything that came out of the Academic Senate, every document. I became such a debater in the Senate, and that you know, because every issue had to be really understood and explained, and there was such inconsistency and mm-hmm. such a double standards when it came to proposals that we had versus other people's proposals, things that we wanted versus others. Such double standard when it came even to kids of color. I mean, I felt I had to defend the kids of color consistently. I remember when we were, I went to the Senate once because we were, we had, there was a whole issue about remedial education at the university. And is it the role of the university to have classes to help students who don't write well, right. and so forth and so on? Right. How low do we go, quote unquote, so forth and so on? And this was at a time when our university could afford to exclude students because we had more students than we needed. Yeah. And we had a lot of students and we were rejecting students and we felt overwhelmed. And anytime we do that, anytime this university feels it has a lot of students, then it figures we have to up the ante. Mm-hmm. We have to get the best of the best of the best of the best, regardless of what the mission of the Cal State system is statewide. And so here we have these people in the Senate fighting about not wanting to offer the basic English, like the lower level English for students who did not do well on the writing test but needed a pre-English to take the basic English. So we have this debate. Well, it was interesting to me because after all that happened and they decided we would do the courses, we had to have the study skills courses or whatever they were, I then go to, about a couple years later, there's a we have an influx of Southeast Asians to come to campus. And we discovered that even though we have basic English and then we have the remedial English, they needed something before remedial, mm-hmm. you know, because they really had very poor writing skills and speaking skills. And so it was interesting that the Senate was going to make a proposal to even have a lower level of English class, which I was not opposed to.
Yeah.
But the argument incensed me so much mm-hmm. that I had to go to the Senate to once again to point out their racism, if no more than just as a teaching moment, you know. And because here I got this letter saying to me that we need this class because the people are not proficient and so forth and so
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
And that we know they're brilliant,
yeah.
even though they can't articulate it. So I'm trying to figure out how in the heck do you know anyone is brilliant if they cannot tell you in some form, okay? So I immediately had to go to the Senate, pull out some papers I had from 2 years before or something, talking about how this institution is not designed to help people who are not ready for it, okay? And yet you know these people are intelligent, but they can't tell you. How? I want someone in the Senate to tell me how you know they're intelligent, other than you have decided because they're of Asian descent that they must be intelligent. And if so, then that shows your racism even more. And of course, the Senate was like quiet. I said, now don't get me wrong. I am 100% in favor of this proposal. But I want you people to understand what you told me 2 years ago. I want you to confront your own racism that you gave me 2 years ago. You know, mm-hmm. and so I, you know, but it was one of those things. I said, you have to consistently find yourself in these positions to, you know, you can't fight every battle, and I don't fight every battle because, Lord, that would kill me. But it's sometimes you have to say, okay, here comes my battle again. Is this the one where I make the point? Because maybe, just maybe, somebody's listening, and maybe, just maybe, they won't make the same mistake again.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that kind of thing that we live with in the early part of Black Studies. So much so that one day I was sitting in a meeting. And this guy, and once again, I'm here defending some curriculum, some other drama. I don't even know what it was, but I had it at that point. And he looks at me and he says to me, why are you here? And I said, you know what? I decided last year that I'm going to stop telling old white men why I'm here. It is your job to research it and find it out. And when you come back with an intelligent question, I will give you an answer. Everybody in the room was like, and that was from that moment on, I have never defended my existence on this mm-hmm. campus until you articulate a good position. And I was telling someone, I realized in my research and study on movement studies that the greatest strategy is always to keep people on the offense. Because if you're on the offense, on the defense.
Yeah.
Because if you're on the defense, you can never score. You can never, and the way you keep people on defense is ask one question, why? Why did you do that? And you can spend all day answering something that people don't even have a desire for the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And when you finish answering that, they'll ask you the other why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, why didn't you do something else? You know, and so you could then write all these papers and do all these things, and in the end, they really don't care.
Mm-hmm.
They really don't care. And so I stopped answering questions of people who cannot give me a good answer. or at least make a question that has some sense. So if you ask me why is Black Studies here, I will not answer you, because it is not worth my time, because you really aren't interested. You have to write a paper on why it shouldn't be here, and then I'll respond to it. See, that takes a lot more time. So most people are not going to do that. And so I tell everybody, sometimes things happen and they want the defense. I don't even go. I was invited to go to Larry Elder's TV program, which I would not want to be caught on TV with him. And he wanted me to defend why we have a Black baccalaureate. Why do you have a Black graduation ceremony, blah, blah, blah. And so someone called me and says, oh, Larry Elder wants you on TV. And I laughed. And I said, has he written a documentation on why there should not be a Black baccalaureate service that has this and that is not a substitute for graduation? Has he done some paper on that I can respond to? They go, no, then I will not go on this program. I said, why? Because for what? I'm not going to stand here and defend something that's almost 30 years old, that has some value to a community, that has some pride to students, that does not in any way denigrate the traditional graduation, mm-hmm. that actually enhances that traditional graduation because students go to all of the services. I am not going to stand here and defend this to a man who has no interest in it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Period. And so I just stopped defending things that don't make sense. And it has made my life easier and calmer, obviously. Because I said, you'd be crazy dealing with all this stuff. But over the years, the department has structured a number of things, I think, that are significant. And I've been fortunate to be a part of that over the years, always thinking, I'm going to leave. And then somebody says, well, you can't leave until I finish. Okay, I'll wait till you finish. And then there's another group that says, you can't leave till I finish. Well, I've got to do my doctoral dissertation. I need you at San Diego State so I can finish it. And so we've worked with students over the years to help them to actually improve themselves and to be the kind of citizens that most of us would love to have been if we had greater support and greater opportunity. We as a department have had a number of chairs over the years and have come and gone. And I think I've served the longest. I think of the almost 30 some odd years of the department, I've probably either served in the leadership role over 15, 16 years on and off mm-hmm. in the department, and probably have more sense of the department's where it's gone, its direction, and things it's done. Over the years, it's done some exciting things. We once had a gospel choir that was wonderful. For a number of years, for about 10 years, we had a dance troupe in the department, the San Diego State University Black Repertory Total Theatrical Experience. It stopped when our director died of AIDS. Unfortunately, Danny Scarborough in 1989. But it was an award-winning dance company that we have lots of videos and tapes of. It won an Emmy, and Danny's hallmark that he would take students who had no dance experience at all and turn them into marvelous dancers. Mm. He even got men to dance with him, Black men who were macho, who were football players, and all those kinds of things to dance. In fact, there's a dance company at Bayview Baptist Church as a result of Danny Scarborough, because Steve Beard was his first male dancer. And Steve Beard directs a dance group very much similar to Danny's in terms of style and performance. And so the dance company was important for students because it created a sense of ownership at San Diego State and a sense of pride.
Mm-hmm.
When it first began with Danny in the late 1980, we could not find a place for it to dance on this campus. The kids practice in Montezuma Hall, and we could not find a venue for them to perform. Mm-hmm. And we would perform at the local high schools, Gompers and other places like that. And then one day, a woman by the name of Betty Nesvall, who was associate dean in the College of Arts and Letters, there's a tree planted for her out there in between the social science and in the social science buildings at the bottom near a Storm Hall.
Yeah.
She was our first female kind of associate dean on campus, and she was a woman who would come back to school after raising 6 or 7 children. And became a very good political scientist and a wonderful woman. And so Betty Nesvall saw the dance company once in Montezuma Hall perform and was so impressed, she called me and says she wanted to meet with me. So she met with us and says, we've got to figure out a way for this campus to highlight this dance company. It is criminal that these kids are not performing on this campus. And so we then start working, because the dance department did not want us dancing in their facilities. They did not want us rehearsing in their gym because it was their space.
Oh.
And so we didn't have, they wouldn't let us use their facilities, even though there was no one using them. It was one of those kind of crazy territorial things. But our dean got together at the time and got together, I think it was Dean Detweiler, and met with the dean of arts of professional studies and fine arts, and they began to work on agreement with between the departments concerning one the gymnasium for rehearsal. So our dean invested some money in having a dance room put together for us, a small room that had ventilation, had mirrors on the wall that our students could practice in. So they were ecstatic about having a dance, a rehearsal room. And then we worked out an arrangement so that we, our student groups performed on main stage at Don Powell Theater. Right after the drama department had done all of its performances and what have you, we did a main stage production every year at the end, during finals week. So it was a highlight of the community that we'd have the theater for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And we'd fill the theater with 500 people every time for this marvelous production. Danny Scarborough then reached out to high school students and even my kids who were 6 and 7 and 8 mm-hmm. years old, danced with the dance company. He would create a position for small children to be in the dance performances. Nice. So they've got great pictures of them dancing. And it was really, I mean, one of the best performances. The reviews by the city were excellent of this dance company. And Danny took these untrained dancers and taught them to dance. They danced almost like the Alvin Ailey dancers out of New York. Yeah, wonderful productions, beautiful videotapes of the students that were done, and just transformed the lives, really, of these young people. It was something that our kids held on to. And it's interesting because I was talking to a former dancer who runs the dance program at Lincoln High School, and he was one of Danny's dancers. He's a teacher now. And he's saying, you know, he wants to commit himself to come back and try to do the dance company. We tried a couple of times, but it was interesting. After Danny's death, We went to organize a dance troupe to discover that the dance department had destroyed our rehearsal room. And exactly, we scheduled class in there and they go, oh, you can't do that. It doesn't. And I went down there and it didn't exist anymore. Then we tried to have a rehearsal space at some other place and that fell apart. So it was really just an obstacle. Once again, the obstacles after 2 years of not having it, they just decimated it. And it was always a sense of a rivalry between Danny Scarborough's dance company and the campus's dance company because they were not doing the kind of cultural productions that Danny was doing, nor getting the kind of attention that they were getting from the dance company that was there. But it was a marvelous experience for students in terms of identity. This coming year, we're going to try to, the dance company, the students who were in the dance company, they've done a production since Danny's death about 10 years ago. They all got together and exercised for a year, you know, because, you know, in fact, I got an email from one who's turning 50 this year. And so they all exercised furiously about 10, 12 years ago, and they did a production in Balboa Park. Because they did productions on campus, they did in Balboa Park. We worked closely with the African Arts Committee. I think they did a thing called Juma Juma in Balboa Park one time. Okay. And that was just a marvelous production to help raise money for the African Arts Committee of Balboa Park. So our dance company became an outreach program. It was also instrumental in bringing in a person by the name of Jack Kimbrough, who was the first black dentist in San Diego, first president of NAACP in San Diego, and was instrumental in many of the sit-ins during the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Kimbrough was an avid collector of African art and materials. And so every year that eventually became an adjunct professor for us, and he would do productions in the library, major displays of his books. He had first edition books from by Frederick Douglass and those kinds of individuals. So he would do, we'd have a major display in the center of the library, the old library, and he would do lectures on his material because he was a great lecturer. Then he'd put on display his mask. He had masks from all over the world. He would put on the mask and he'd do a production, a lecture on that. Or he had all this metal work that came out of certain parts of Africa and he'd have displays. So he was a wonderful addition as an adjunct to the faculty. He would do lectures for our classes. He never got paid. He would, if we had calls to say we'd like someone to come lecture at a school, Dr. Kimbrough would load his stuff in his car and he'd go and do these lectures for us and those kinds of things. He was an interesting person who ended up being really the grandson of Andrew Jackson, or the great-grandson of him, one. His mother looked just like Andrew Jackson, which is a horrible thought. But I remember they did a special on him in San Diego, and he had a picture of his mother. And they superimposed Andrew Jackson's face on his mother. And they looked like they almost identical. I think she was either his out-of-wedlock daughter, you know, typical kind of thing, or a granddaughter one, but he was a descendant of Andrew Jackson. So his name was Jackson Kimbrough, Jack Jackson Kimbrough. And And a marvelous addition to the campus, marvelous outreach person, he and his wife, Quincella. And so we had this wonderful relationship built from the dance troupe with Dr. Kimbrough and the culture that was there. So the department engaged in a lot of cultural activities in its initial phase. In fact, my secretary was telling me she's going through all the files and stuff to give to the library. And she was saying, wow, you guys did all these great Black history programs, because we did, when, you know, in the initial phase of struggling to get identity on campus and what have you, we would appeal to every department on campus to basically help us to do something in the area of Black history. And so every department on campus would sponsor a Black history event. So we'd have this huge calendar. People in the sciences would do things on Blacks and scientists and, or engineering or a journalism or whatever it was. And so we had this very extensive program on Black history that was there. And that was important. In 79, when I first became chair in 1979, our graduations on this campus, I mean, we're civilized now, but I mean, in the 1970s and the early 80s, we were known throughout the city as having the most disruptive graduations probably on the face of the earth. I mean, we were out in this bowl outside that was so depersonalized. Oh. Nobody's name was ever called. So students would get beach balls, and they'd hit beach balls all during graduation. I can remember when Yvonne Braithwaite Burke came here to speak, marvelous congresswoman. And here they were, beach balls flying all around the field while she's talking. Students would bring in, maybe five or six champagne bottles underneath their robe. They're corking champagne bottles all during graduation. They're hitting. I mean, it was really embarrassing. And the newspapers and the media would come to take pictures of all the students doing these crazy things. You know, it was just totally embarrassing.
Yeah, yeah.
So we said, okay, let's do something different for graduation. So we decided, based on the African-American tradition of Black colleges, that we would have a baccalaureate service. Not a graduation, not to rival with graduation, but a baccalaureate service, and that we'd have it in the community. We'd host it in a Black church, and we would structure it so that it was a rite of passage for students and their families. So we began the first one in 1980, and we had it held at this small Lutheran church on 54th Street. Maybe, 150 people showed up for the service. And then from that, and we even had dancers at the service. From that, it grew to a couple of hundred. And then it grew to the point where, now we have to look for space because we're 1,500 people at baccalaureate service. Students start calling us far in advance, wanting to know where it is, when is it, those kinds of things. And this coming year, in May of this year, we'll celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Black Baccalaureate. When we did the 25th anniversary, we invited students back from all 25 of the classes. And so we had 25 former graduates to march in the baccalaureate who had been a part of the baccalaureate experience from the beginning. And so it's really a tradition that students call us still about, asking about the baccalaureate and participation in it and those kinds of things. And interestingly enough, out of it has grown others, because I remember a woman came here from Indiana maybe after we'd had about 9 or 10 of them. Mm-hmm. And she was there for the graduation of her kid. And she worked at the University of Indiana. And she called and says, could you help us develop a program? So we sent her all of our material. So they do one. UC Irvine now does one. UCSD does one. Huh. And others began to develop these baccalaureate services. I said, we're not in competition with graduation. We're not pretending to give a degree or anything like that. That's for the university to do. This is a time when, as a community, we come together to celebrate the achievement of our children, but also the achievement of the community.
That's lovely.
That every graduate stands on the shoulders of all these hopes and dreams of former slaves who would have done this if they could. And so it's a time for family. It's a time for community, for people to really celebrate. And that's why we take it to the community, so that little kids up and down the street can say, wow, look, there's a whole bunch of kids over there with those funny looking robes on, who are graduating, who are basically
right.
celebrating their
right,
achievement.
Right.
So we do this every year. And as I said, and we've done it in various ways. We've raised money for it. In fact, when we first began, I always begin, because I come from the poverty mentality. And students can't afford to do this. So we raise money. We have the students have car washes and link sales. And then one day, I got tired of that. I said, you know what? I think these students have money. So I said, okay, the baccalaureate costs you $25.
Ah.
No problem. Everybody paid. I said, why am I washing cars? Why are we having link sales? Why are we doing these crazy things? These students buy CDs. They buy everything in the world they want, okay?
Yeah.
So we just said, baccalaureate is $25, and they all came across with $25. In the years, I think we've been charging now for about 10 years or so, and I've only had one person who didn't have the money. I said, fine, and they just marched. But I've never had a person say, I don't have $25. I don't have $30. I mean, whatever it is. And it's really kind of funny, you know, because here I was thinking, oh, these poor students like me, you know, they probably don't have money. I don't want a student to be denied an opportunity, da-da-da. And so I thought, but after I got tired, I said, you know, we just charge them, you know, because I had a committee that didn't want to raise money. You know, we'd have a committee of students, and they want to do this. I said, well, just charge them. And they all had money. I thought, oh, my God, wake up, Shirley. These students can afford what they want. And so we began that process, so it made it a whole lot easier for us. But at our service, we give the students a piece of kente cloth that represents their heritage and their culture for them to wear at the main graduation. So they wear their kente at the main graduation. We have African drummers. We videotape, so we have lots of videotapes we're going to give to the university of all of our baccalaureate services. And it's usually a really wonderful experience of gospel choirs, African drummers, students who speak. We used to let the honor students speak, but then we realized they don't always have a story to tell. You know, sometimes they're honor students because they had nothing going but going to school.
Mm-hmm.
So what can they tell us, you know? So we stopped that. We did that one year, and we found out those speeches were kind of boring. You know, I mean, some of them were okay, but many of them were very boring.
Yeah.
So we said, rather than getting the summa cum and the magna cums and kuma kumas to speak, you know, let's find out who has a story. So we started a competition.
I love it.
We said, okay, if you want to speak at the baccalaureate, you have to come and prepare a 5-minute speech on the topic. And the faculty sits and listens to these speeches and see who has something to say to the graduates and their families. And so that's how we choose our speakers. We select one of the ministers from the community to give the charge, and then we select a student. We select students who have a message. And then we select one student who will accept the charge from the graduates. And that one student is someone who has done something significant to improve the lives of students on campus.
That's wonderful.
You know? And so, and as a result, it ends up being a good program.
It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, so I'll just put it on and you can pick up.
Mm-hmm. Clearly, the Africana Studies Department became, in many ways, a central piece of the cultural life and the activities of students on the campus. We became significant because we were the body of, say, black experts on campus who could really represent the interest of students and community. So we became the link between the larger community, the black student community, and the university in terms of making sure that the issues of diversity and equal opportunity were always on the table. And as I said, we took that responsibility seriously because if we didn't, no one else would. We felt we also had a responsibility to try to educate the university about people of color. And to work very hard to make sure that people of color, that women had a place and a space at a university like this, which was not always welcome and not always easy because you're dealing with a campus that's predominantly male, oftentimes white male. Expectations is that you will do the white male thing even if you're not the white male. If you're the female, that you will still do the white male thing, that you would be the carrier of that particular viewpoint and culture wherever you went. So we found ourselves in a position where we were constantly trying to make sure the university would be receptive, you know, that we would be able to take our community and bring our community into the campus and vice versa. And so to that extent, we did a lot of things that were outreach efforts in the community, whether it's working with high school students. We wanted to make sure that we did those kinds of things that were there, making sure that the curriculum we had was one that was not only supportive of students on campus but off campus. We mentored an awful lot of students, a tremendous number of students. There's probably not a very few African-American students who went through this campus that did not in some way meet the faculty, become a part of the faculty, become a part of our families, become known by the faculty, and that we helped to get to grad schools and PhD programs and all those kinds of things. I mean, I still serve on PhD programs of students who were former students of mine years ago who were at Pepperdine. I just did one at SC recently. The California School of Professional Psychology, all of us have been on those doctoral doctoral committees around the nation because of our work and our mentorship, not only our research, but our work and our mentorship with those students who are on this campus. Being on a campus like this can be a very alienating experience for many students who come in. And I guess I could identify with that because, you know, you're a small population. You're about 3% of the total student population. If you've not had much contact with universities before, what they do here could be very different and foreign to you. You're apprehensive about approaching faculty. So sometimes students who actually come to Black Studies, some come because they're interested. They want to be in the discipline. They take classes that are of interest to them. And then we end up with some students who come to us kind of, I always say, through the back door. After they've been somewhere else, they've been somehow or another bruised in some fashion. Either their sense of self or their academics have been abused in some way. They then come to us looking for somebody to listen to, knock on the door and say, I've got this problem. Somebody told me I should come over here to figure out how I can solve it. Since there are not that many counselors on the campus that are African American, those kinds of things, I recognize students are sometimes apprehensive to tell their story mm-hmm. to people who they feel will not appreciate it or will simply say, oh, that's what's wrong with Black people. That's why you got this kind of problem. Yeah. And so we have students who come and who tell us, give us their story. And we do our best in some way to try to help and advocate for those students to have a decent academic career on this campus. So it has been that kind of spirit that has always existed for us. Through our outreach efforts, through the classes we've offered, through the dance company, through our baccalaureate service, through our Black History programs, and a host of other kinds of things, we've done that. More recently, we began to realize that a significant part of the life of students on any university nowadays is study abroad, that students want to go abroad, that they need to have an international experience that's unique. So we naturally felt that the place for our students would be to go to Africa. I first took some students to Africa. They weren't SDSU students. They were actually middle school students to Africa and when I was involved with the NAACP's Young Scholar Program. But after that, we began to network with different groups in Africa and began to realize that we needed to develop a program. So we helped with, we started something called the Alternative Spring Break in 2001. We were participating in the Alternative Spring Break with Costa Rica and with Mexico. As a department, we just kind of helped to sponsor it in general because we had a faculty member, Pat Washington, who was very interested in it, and she was in women's studies. But in 2003, I was approached by a student. In fall of 2002, I was approached by a student that says, why don't you go to South Africa? So I thought to myself, that's crazy. That's 10,000 miles away. How are we going to get students to South Africa? But I thought, okay. I talked to the guy he referred me to because he was our student body president, and he had gone. And so he says, talk to this guy, Marlon Smith. So I called Marlon. And Marlon was in the States, and Marlon came to see me. Marlon was a part of a program called Success by Choice, run out of L.A., but he lived half of the year in South Africa, U.S. citizen. So I talked to Marlon, and I said, he came down, and we had this lunch, and we talked about going to South Africa and what he could do and so forth and so on. So I was kind of apprehensive, but I thought, whatever. So Pat and I were going to do the South Africa thing, and then she couldn't go, so I took one of my other faculty members. But we started advertising and hustling and begging and borrowing and asking students to go. And our service learning program sponsored the faculty to go. So we finally were able to scrape together by pushing and pulling about 11 or 12 students to go to South Africa. And our very first trip. And it was one of these exploratory trips. But, I mean, we were begging and borrowing and finding money and, you know, cajoling students to go and said, you got to go, you got to go, you got to go. So we ended up with a pretty diverse group of students, about half of them African-American, the other white and Asian and Hispanic students. So we all pack up and we go 10,000 miles to South Africa. And it was a marvelous experience. I mean, it was a wonderful experience. Yeah. The campus wasn't that excited about us going to South Africa. In fact, we have not really gotten much encouragement, period, about going to Africa, period. People felt, oh, nobody really wants to go. The university has its own thing. I mean, this was the initial phase. No one was excited about us going to South Africa or Africa, period. So after we came back, we said, okay, we've got this South Africa alternative spring break thing going. And each year it got better. I remember meeting with Nancy Marlin, and she said, and we talked at Provost, and she says, well, because she was real big on study abroad. I said, well, our best our best salespeople will be the students who go and come back and talk about their experience. That will sell the program. We struggle to get the first group together. I mean, we really struggle to get those few students to come up with $3,300 to go to South Africa. The next year, we ended up, we went from 13 to about 20 students. Okay. Our third year, we went up to about 25 or so. Our fourth year, we had 44 students to go to South Africa. Our last year, not this one, then our fifth year, we had 40 students to go to South Africa. And this past year, we had, we've cut it off at 36, I think, students, or 35 or 36 to go to South Africa. It has been a wonderful experience where we've blended culture and academics and studying about racism and apartheid and Jim Crow with service. So that we go and we contribute to the South African community. Our kids volunteer at youth centers. We take shoes. We take school supplies. We take things for children. This year, we started a feeding program. As a result of last year's project, we are basically providing lunch because we raised the money through the community and through the National Council of Black Studies, lunch for students at a middle school for every day for a poor school where kids did not have lunch. And the principal said to me, well, really breakfast, he said to me last year when I was there in 2006-07, he said, if you could give my kids a piece of bread, some peanut butter, and some tea with a little sugar in it for energy, it would make a world of difference in the academic life of the children at this school, the Roma Lele School. And this was out in a small place called Sharpeville. So I said, okay. So I came back and I said, how much would that cost me? They said it would cost you $300 a month to feed the children that little menu at that school, about $300-$400 a month. So I went to my friends and others around the city. I had Kwanzas at my house and told folks what I wanted. Then I went to a friend of mine passed away. I went to the National Council of Black Studies, and they gave me $3,600 for the first year of breakfast for this group, along with the other money I had raised. But our kids give back. I mean, a significant part of that is that we give back. So in 2006, I believe it was, I got this call about my trip to South Africa. That's when I had 44 people, and I had already had my 40-some-odd students to go. And we were just overwhelmed. Not only do we have, not only does this program now have students, but we also have high school students to go with us. Because a friend of mine at Crawford, who does a group called Diamonds in the Rough, said, I want to go, one of these times, Shirley, I'm going to go to South Africa with you. So the year she decided to take off from work and go to South Africa, I said, excuse me, you have not been invited to go. She said, well, I'm going to go anyway. I said, well, I'm not going to take you unless you take high school students. She goes, oh, my God. You know, now I've got to raise money for a bunch of kids. So we took five high school students from Crawford to South Africa with us. That was a life-changing experience for five kids who had been all kinds of issues in their lives, but they raised that money. They did all kinds of things. And so we took students from Crawford. We took senior citizens. One of our members was 75. We took maybe five or six of them, so a couple of teachers. So we had about 30-some-odd students and about eight or nine community leaders. So we kind of have this intergenerational thing going to South Africa. So I've got my kids ready to go, and all of a sudden I get this call. I come in from my office, and my secretary, my administrative coordinator, says, Dr. Weber, MTV called. I said, yeah, and they want to go to South Africa. I said, no way, and I kept going. You must call them back. No, I don't. And my students are standing there with their mouths open. You're not going to call MTV? Oh, my God. You've got to call MTV. It's like Jesus had called. I said, no, I don't have to call MTV. They were just devastated. So MTV called again. So finally, I called MTV. And the lady says, we really want to come talk to you. But I said, how did you find out about me? She said, well, we do the spring break thing with all the, you know, wet T-shirts and the drunk students at the beaches and things. And someone says you should do something positive, the alternative spring break, blah, 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 blah. She says, so we Googled alternative spring break, and what pops up is San Diego State. We read about your program. We talked to a couple of people. We want to go to South Africa with you. I said, I have to think about it. So they came to San Diego, and they assured me, we will not intervene. We will not make this into this. We will not take over. We will just follow you, da, 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 da. I said, okay. So my students were just ecstatic, of course. So MTV joined us in South Africa in something called the Amazing Break, and they picked five programs in the nation to basically travel with and to look at what they did. So we were featured internationally on The Amazing Break. It was a wonderful experience for the students. I mean, to me, it was so-so. It was okay. It was MTV, you know. And it was maybe five minutes of television time. But they did a really nice job about our kids, what they do, the schools, the shoes that we took to the school, our volunteer work at one of a center that has 1,000 kids who've been abused. We work with them. What the things our kids learned, they had a chance to talk about what they did. And so it was a good experience. And of course, and that immediately sparked the next 40 students to go to South Africa. But, and we also televised, we also, and when I had a radio program, we actually broadcast live from South Africa. I wasn't there. I said, I'm going to be in South Africa, but I'm going to broadcast live on one of the local channels. And because the channel was not only, it was on the internet as well as local here, we called in. They waited for us. And our people, the kids' parents and the citizens of San Diego heard us live for an entire hour from South Africa over the phone. So it was a live broadcast from South Africa. It was like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning in South Africa, in Johannesburg. I was in my suite, and the students came to my suite, and we had a phone we had about 3 or 4 phones. We didn't have a speaker phone, and the kids could go back and forth using the phone, and they called us, and you know, our kids were live. I had a friend of mine to go into the studio to kind of MC for us, and we got call-in questions from parents and family members and friends about South Africa. So that was great. We each tried each year to do something different. We tried for several years to do a live broadcast, a video conference from South Africa. And every year, they didn't have the right hookup, they didn't have the right cord, they didn't have something. And so a couple of times, even in the embassy, they don't have great technology. Uh-huh. So even in the embassy, we did just the oral thing, just a live conference taping, but we didn't do the video. This year, for the first time, at Wits University, Witwatersrand University, we had the live hookup video conference from South Africa to our campus. And it was exciting. So now we know we can do it. And in fact, it was, you know, all credit to our campus, because each year we tried for about 3 years to try to do this hookup, and we couldn't. So I said, you know, forget it, screw it, it ain't gonna work. Okay, we don't have to do it. But our folks, our guy over here says, nothing defeats me, Shirley. We are going to have this conference. I think I got it down. I mean, he was determined. And I had given up. I said, forget it. And we got on. We were live. In fact, we were at Wits University being hosted by a women's group there. It's called Every Woman is what the name of this women's group. They host us every year at a reception and a discussion with our students, because they love to be with our students. And so I said, fine. So we were there. And when the guy came in and said, my little faculty member, he was over there when it came on. He came running back across campus. We are on. We are live. It's going to happen. And this is like the culmination of 4 years of struggle to have a live video conference. Even in the embassy, we couldn't get hookup. And so fortunately, this time, we were live with the students from South Africa, with our kids. And the parents here in San Diego were cheering in the audience to see us. And they were ecstatic. Because here we were 10,000 miles away, talking to our family, letting them meet our friends in South Africa, talking about the issues in San Diego as well as the issues in South Africa. So this year, we look forward to going back again and maybe structuring the conference so that it really is a panel discussion of individuals with issues in South Africa, issues in the U.S. So we were able to do that this year. For the first time, we did a live video conference from South Africa. So each year our program gets better, it grows. As aside from the program, we, because of our relationship we developed with the embassy, with programs there, this year was the first time the embassy hosted a huge barbecue for us. So our students got a chance to eat giraffe, wildebeest, zebra, all those things they pet in the zoo. They had a chance to have it for lunch. And some of them were like, oh no, I can't. But they ate it. They enjoyed it. It was delicious, because they had sausages and hamburgers and steaks made out of it. It didn't look like the giraffe, so it was fine. But we had a gentleman at the embassy, a woman's husband, who does this game hunting. And so he went out the week before, especially for us, he said, to hunt the game. And next week, he said he'll get us some warthog. He said, that is really delicious. So next year, we'll try the warthog. But also, as a result of that, we work with kids from South Africa, and they come to visit us now. So last year was our first visit of 12 students from South Africa, high school students who were here for the Tony Robbins Leadership Camp. They came to San Diego. The camp is always held in San Diego. And so they came this time to San Diego, but they wanted to spend time with us. And so we had them for 3 days in our homes. We had members of the communities to host them. We hosted them on campus. One church did a barbecue for them at the park, at the beach. We went to Mission Beach. And they had a whole barbecue for them. So they got a chance to meet young people. They lived in our homes. They got to know us personally. This year in August, we're having 20 of them come. There'll be 17 students, 3 chaperones. We're in the process of organizing all their lodging and what have you. They'll be doing their camp, and they'll be with us for 2 days. And we've already got churches organized that want to host dinners for them, rap group with young people. Our dean is going to have a session with them. The international program is going to do some stuff with them. So we will get a chance. Our students will get a chance to be exposed to kids internationally for, you know, that period of time. And I tell students, I mean, I think that's extremely important. One of the benefits of my life as a child who didn't have much was there was always somebody wanting to do something at my school that was great. And I had a teacher when I was in junior high, I don't remember which one it was, whose mother went to Australia and came back with a list of kids who wanted pen pals. And I had a pen pal from the time I was in junior high till I graduated and went to college. And he sent me wonderful little gifts, and I sent him little gifts. I still have the tea cloth from with a giraffe on it or something that I had from when I was, you know, in junior high school. A charm bracelet that my wrist can no longer accommodate, but I still have it. And so I had a wonderful pen pal that we wrote to every day. And I thought, you know, writing was so important in those days. And we started off, many of people started writing and they stopped, but I kept my pen pal the whole time. And he would always write me and ask me one critical question: have you seen any movie stars today? And I don't know what he thought happened in Los Angeles and South Central LA, but I'd have to tell him, I've probably seen as many as you've seen on the screen, but I'd not seen any lately. But he always thought there would be movie stars walking up and down the streets of Los Angeles. But I got a peep into his world in Australia, and it was really wonderful. We exchanged photographs and things of that nature, and it was just great having a pen pal on the other side of the world. So I tell students, you know, having friends around the world is really important. It enhances your horizon. It gives you hope about what is possible for the world and the good things that are there. So, you know, over the years, Africana Studies has made an effort to constantly be in a state of transition. One of the things, our latest transition now, is the offering of courses in the larger community. We offer a class at the Malcolm X Library, free to the community. And we were amazed when we first offered this course. I offered it about 4 or 5 years ago, that so many people showed up, that people were interested in knowledge. We had an 8-week session when we first started, and it was called Africana Cultural Exposure, A Legacy of Resilience and Resistance and Resiliency. And we had different professors do a different night on a particular topic related to that, on their specialty. We duplicated materials. We said, okay, the first 50 people, if you will register, we'll give you free material, because I'd gotten a grant to get this done from the community. And it was a $1,500 grant. Well, I came back, I left and sent the stuff, and the librarian and Malcolm X Library sent out a notice to everybody in the community. By the time I came back to my office the next morning, I said, who did I insult? I have 50-some-odd messages on my machine. I thought, oh, my God. I tried to think, what was I in the paper about? Did I do something as usual, you know, to make somebody upset? They were all people registering for the class, wanting that material. He said he had so many at the library. We ended up with about 100-and-some people in this class, aged from 8 to 80. Mm-hmm. We had one woman who had a night kind of after-school care for parents who worked at night, and she had 8, 9, 10-year-old kids. She had 8 of them. She brought them to the class every Thursday night. We had senior citizens who came. I ended up having to get an additional grant to pay for the material to duplicate for people. And at the end of it, we did a study of the group, asking them questions, surveying them. And all of them said they would, you know, yeah, they would come. They would even pay to come. So we charged them $5 for the materials or whatever. And we offered a class in the fall and one in the spring every year. And we ended up giving academic credit for students who wanted to enroll through extension. So students ended up getting about, I think they ended up getting about 4 university credits out of all the 8 classes we offered, those who chose to. We had people who came to every class. Mm-hmm. And the classes ranged sometimes 40, 50 people in the class, up to maybe, like I said, 100 and some in the first one. And so as a result, we promised the library, and we're going to do 2 classes this fall again, but we will also offer classes, a regular class that we offer at the university at the library so that our students can go there and go to class. But it was interesting because at the first year we did it, it showed up in the newspaper as the best, one of the best bets in the Union Trib, that this is the best bet. You know, you get a free class taught by professors in the university, interaction, discussion, films, all kinds of things, wonderful experience, and it was really an exciting class, and it still is. When we offer it, our students, that we still have the list of students, we send them a notice and enroll, you know, that, so it says to me very clearly, this community wants to learn, and what I missed, like I told them, what I missed in the community was intellectual exchange, and so now we have an opportunity to have intellectual exchange. We have all kinds of folks who come to the class. We also have our court schools where kids have been in trouble and pregnant and so forth and so on. They come. The teachers come and give the students academic credit for coming to class. So those students who are, some of them come with newborn babies and all kinds of stuff. They come to the class. They enjoy it. We have people who live in the community who are non-African Americans. In fact, there's one guy who's white and his son. They come to every class. So we have just a real good cross-section of individuals who come to listen to the professors, to get the material, to engage in the discussions. And my faculty, I thought I, you know, to have twist my arm for the faculty, they love it. They don't, anytime I say, are we willing to do it? Everybody, yeah, put me down. I want to do so-and-so. I want to do this because they love the exchange that occurs with the students, with the community. And now for our students, if they take two of the classes, they can get one unit of credit for coming. So now some of our students show up as well. So we're working to do more outreach so that we can truly impact the academics and the intellectual development of the Southeast community.
Well, that's wonderful.